second case for oral argument this morning was Dennis Most, appellant versus State of South Dakota, appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Michael McGill, an attorney from Beresford, and for the appellee, we have Mr. Ronald Tinklepaw, an assistant attorney general from Peer. Let noted before, Justice Conan Camp is not physically present. He is recovering from surgery, but is listening to the arguments on the internet and will fully conference with us on this case, as well as all other cases this term. With that, Mr. McGill, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Justice Gilbertson.
Please, the court and counsel. Phil Peterson, I represented Dennis Most in Union County Circuit Court. He was charged by the state with four charges of first-degree rape, very serious charges. He was also charged in the alternative with four counts of sexual contact. He waived the jury trial. The trial result was that he was acquitted of the four rape charges, and he was found guilty of the four sexual contact charges. He was sentenced to a total of 25 years in prison, and he presently is serving that sentence. The interesting note here is that after the court entered the ruling on the prior bad act issue in this case, he waived a jury trial. Mr. Most was advised that he had a right to a jury trial, and Mr. Peterson and I went over that with him over and over again, and he decided to waive a jury trial. In any event, it was a trial to the court. The prayer for relief, what we're asking for, is for the court to review the discretion exercised by Judge Jensen, the trial court judge, with respect to two rulings. One deals with prior bad act evidence. The second one deals with the judge's refusal to allow us to put into evidence proof of a prior false claim of sexual assault. The third issue we raise on appeal deals with the general sufficiency of the evidence. I'm going to spend my time talking about the first issue. I think that's the issue perhaps the court is most interested in. I think that the other two issues are fairly treated and fairly argued in the briefs that were submitted by the court. With respect to the issues on appeal, the first one, there are several social policy implications that arise with respect to SDCL 1912-3 and 1912-5. The law students will know this as the propensity rule. The propensity rule, which is Rule 404B of the Federal Rules of Evidence for all the non-lawyers in the House, basically says that evidence of a prior bad act cannot be used in the case in chief to prove that the defendant acted in conformity therewith. However, and it's a big however, that evidence can be used to prove other issues in the case, such as absence of mistake, intent, preparation, motive, plan, and so on. The balancing test steps in after the court determines that it's relevant, if the court makes that determination. The balancing test is under 403 of the federal rules, and that case, that statute says that the court, even though relevant, even though that prior bad act is relevant, it should be excluded from evidence because of the danger of unfair prejudice, and that unfair prejudice has to substantially outweigh the probative value of that evidence. I know the court knows that. I don't know whether the non-lawyers in the audience, but that's what this case is really about. It's about balancing those two statutes, the propensity rule and the balancing test. The propensity rule is based on, I guess you would say, social psychology. There's a lot of policy behind the propensity rule. It deals with the presumption of innocence. When someone comes into a court of law and they're charged with a crime, they should be either acquitted or convicted based upon what comes out of the witness stand and what the evidence is. They shouldn't be convicted on the basis of what they did 26 years ago or 41 years ago before the trial, as happened in this case, with respect to the niece, S.M. It also touches upon the right to due process. That's why it's a very important case. So any ruling made by this court is very important from that angle. Every ruling made by this court is important, but this one is particularly important for this reason. In almost every criminal case, prior bad act comes up. If a prosecutor has prior bad acts in his back pocket, he can negotiate a tougher plea bargain, he can restrict the defendant's right to request a jury trial, and it involves the defendant's right to have the other side of the story told. So that's why any decision the court makes regarding prior bad acts hits the very stake, the very heart of the criminal justice process. Also, in a sexual abuse case, such as we have in this case, the prior bad acts are highly prejudicial, we allege, because it, in usually, when you have a sexual abuse case, you have a disclosure that takes place over several months. There are no witnesses to the acts. There's rarely medical evidence. And that was the situation with Mr. Most's case. And so then when you have prior bad acts come in, on the balance beam of justice, you already have it somewhat weighted down in favor of the state. Also, there's the risk that a jury, in this case it wasn't a jury, but in future cases when this case is cited, there could be a jury that would decide the case. And
an interesting point, counsel. Is there a different standard or a different way we look at this because it's a bench trial versus a jury trial?
Well, I think on a remand for a jury trial, it wouldn't, obviously. But I don't think, I think the fact finder would still be burdened by the duty to place proper weight on that prior bad act evidence and not use it to convict the defendant.
You're saying that's improper means of persuasion. Is that more of a risk in front of a jury than in front of a trial court, which is presumed to know the law?
I think my gut reaction would be it would be, because we would think that the court would put proper weight upon that prior bad act evidence to view only intent or absence of mistake, and not whether we should convict this person because he's a bad person. So,
does that get more complicated than just in this case? Because if you prevail and we remand it, what happens to the waiver of the jury trial? Is it going back for potentially a jury trial, or has the waiver, or is that an issue we have to worry about?
Well, I think that I don't think the waiver is absolute. I think he can revoke his waiver. The state's attorney would have to consent to it. The state's attorney had to consent to the waiver of the jury trial. But if it were remanded, and this is a way that I think, if I can get to the meat of the matter.
Please do. Maybe we don't need to address that.
Yeah, but that's an interesting question. Here's how the court could rule for my client, if I could help you do that. There are two sets of prior bad acts in this case. One involves a niece with the initials SM. The other involves a stepdaughter with the initials of LS. Now, according to the case law, there's countless cases on this thing. This issue has been before the court several times. But if you read Fisher, your most recent ruling, in Armstrong, and Werner, which is the Watertown minister case, and Chamley, just to take four cases out of literally 10, 20, 30, 40 cases, there's basically four different things you look at: remoteness in time, similarity, reliability, and I can't remember the fourth one, but it's reliability, remoteness, necessity of the evidence, and the similarity of victim offenses and occasions. Now, what KD, the victim in this case, alleged is that on four different occasions, from 1996 to 2003, my client sexually molested her. Now, also came into evidence as a result of admissions that my client made in meetings that he had with his other victims. With respect to MS, his niece, that occurred in 1969 when my client was 19 years of age. That's 26 years before the trial. That involved masturbation to the point of ejaculation in front of a small child, fellatio, sexual contact, and touching of her vagina. Now, it's important. You have to explode the prior bad acts, according to the cases that I've read, in order to analyze the offenses and compare it to what happened in the case in chief. So it's our contention that it's a highly sensational, highly prejudicial information. The fellatio and the masturbation to ejaculation are much more sensational and more prejudicial, and that evidence was let into the trial when the charge was digital penetration, rape, and sexual contact. So I think the case with SM and KD, KD is the current victim, and the case with SM is different factually than the case with LS, the second victim, who claimed, and my client admitted, sexual contact between the ages of 4 and 11, between the years of 1977 and 1984. So I guess my point is that you can bifurcate the two sets of prior bad acts. And Fisher, the other thing about this case that's interesting is that at what point does the exception swallow the rule? The propensity rule, based upon eons of human behavior, is that you can't convict somebody based upon what they did, except all these exceptions. At what point do those exceptions swallow the rule? If a case like this, an event that happened 26 years before, comes in, I think it swallowed the rule. I think it's almost as if the court should say, there's a special rule on sexual offense cases that any prior bad act comes in. If that's the rule, that's what it should be. But I think the abuse of discretion that occurred in this case is that Judge Jensen should have the LS set of facts is completely different. It's very similar in time or kind, very similar victim, same behavior, and it's less remote. It's only 12 years before the trial. But SM is 26 years before. It's dissimilar in terms of offense. It's dissimilar. Now, the statement in State versus Fisher, the 2010 case that dealt with a juvenile, says that the more remote in time, the more strikingly similar the prior bad act has to be. And it's our contention that when you go back 26 years, that's a long time, if there's dissimilarity, then that should be kept out. So the court could have ruled, and this court could rule, that it was an abuse of discretion to allow in the 26-year-old business, but it wasn't error to allow in the 12-year-old business. I think Justice Gilbertson said that abuse of discretion is, if you're shooting at a target and you miss the target, then that's an abuse of discretion. But if you hit the target, you don't have to be a bullseye.
Right.
It doesn't have to be a bullseye. But it's our claim that to allow in the 26-year-old stuff was an air ball. I mean, I've been watching too much basketball, but that's, you've got to hit the target. And I think that you could rule in my client's favor by looking at the niece testimony, SM, differently than LS. The other thing about letting someone come in to testify about something that occurred 41 years ago is memory, the human frailty of memory. You know, the thing about memory is you can't remember what you want to remember, and you can't forget what you don't want, you want to forget. But I guess my point is, on page 220 to 224 of the trial transcript, SM, who's now 47 years of age, comes in and testifies about what happened 41 years ago. She struggles. Mr. Miller, the state's attorney, he had her set up a benchmark of her younger sister being born, and so she was able to fix upon the age of 6, that she was 6 when this happened with her uncle. But she says, and it's printed throughout those 4 pages of the testimony, I really don't remember, that's a long time ago, you know, I know something happened, but I just can't really detail it step by step. That was a long time ago. So now the state will argue that remoteness should only deal with the time of the prior bad act and when this event occurred. And that fails to take into account the situation we have in this particular case where the actual events occurred 41 years ago. And so I think we're getting pretty close. Fisher Fisher drew a line. It was a shaft of light for the defense bar. It said when you have a juvenile, and a juvenile does a prior bad act, that should not be admissible against him when he's an adult. Fisher was, I think, 17 years of age when that event occurred. He abused his stepsister. He was later charged with a sex-related crime. I believe he was 27. The court ruled that it's too remote in time, it's dissimilar, and more importantly, he was a juvenile, and he was not baked yet. He's not done growing. People change. People rehabilitate. People are different when they get older. If I could talk about necessity...
Well, before you do that, let me go back to the rules, because as I understand the record, your client admitted to touching the breasts, inner thighs, and vaginal area of the victim in this case, admitted that it could have been inappropriate, but essentially was arguing that it was accidental and unintentional. And so, are you focusing on 404B on relevance, or are you looking at 403 on probative versus prejudicial?
Well,
because it seems to me when your client admits that, the relevancy issue is it's open and shut, it would seem to me.
Well, I think that what the court has said in those cases is that there's two steps in the analysis. The first is the factual relevance. The second is the legal or logical relevance.
So, and I'm asking which rule?
I'm relying upon the balancing test. 403B. I'm saying that, you know, as defense counsel, Mr. Peterson and I, we stayed away. We tried to stay away from arguing anything about absence of mistake or intent. We tried to focus our attack in this case on credibility of the victim and lack of access by my client. My client, by the way, before he got a hold of his lawyers, or his lawyers got a hold of him, called the police on June. He called the police several times. In June and early July of 2009, and wanted a meeting. What happened on that, Justice Incher, is my client received a series of three phone calls in June of 2009 from his former girlfriend's granddaughter, KD, said that, "Grandpa, you touched me." And he said on the phone, "Well, you must be mistaken. I don't know. You misunderstood." And then the police came and interviewed him on June 29th. Interviewed my client, and my client said, "Well, I tickled her and I wrestled with her, and there may have been some touching, but it was completely inadvertent." Subsequent to that, my client called the DCI investigator and the detective from Union County and requested a meeting, which was held on July 9th of 2009, in which my client basically said that you got this all wrong. It was all inadvertent. It was a mistake. There's no intent. So my client raised that. The point is that the factual relevance, I'm not arguing that. I think that we lose on that argument. And in Omdurchek, you will, that doesn't matter. When a state has to prove a specific intent crime, a general denial raises that issue of intent anyway. So on factual relevance, I think we lose that argument. We're arguing on the logical or legal relevance, and that focuses on reliability, remoteness, similarity of offenses, similarity of victim, similarity of occasions, and necessity.
2 minutes, counsel.
Necessity for the evidence. I think that...
Do I understand the record correctly? Your client also admitted to some inappropriate touching with one of the prior bad act cases.
Yes. Yeah. On the reliability factor, I think there's differences in the case law depending on whether it's a prior conviction or whether it's prior bad act that's testified by people. This case is unique because my client admitted to the victims. He came clean. He said, "You know, I'm sorry for what happened." So this case is unique in that respect. But so I think the reliability is not an issue here. We have to concede that because the prior bad acts happened, according to my client. I think the remoteness is a big issue with respect to SM, not so much with LS. The similarity of offenses, I think, is a big issue with respect to SM because it was completely different behavior, much more sensational and highly prejudicial. And I want to get to the issue of necessity. That comes up over and over again in all these prior Bad Act cases. How bad does the state need this evidence? Well, did they need it on intent? If you let the LS testimony in, that's 12 years old, you don't need SM. So that's how you could rule for my client. You could rule that the it should be remanded for a retrial, and the older stuff should be kept out and remanded and allow in LS. They don't need SM. That's not necessary. Secondly, there's testimony in the record that indicated that my client inquired of the victim, did you like it when he was having sexual contact with her? Third, and they didn't do this in the first trial, they didn't call in a child sexual abuse accommodation syndrome witness because of the delayed disclosure the whole process that happened. From the first interview of KD on March 3rd of 2009 until the grand jury testimony in August of 2009, she was interviewed five different times.
Okay, your time has expired, Mr. McGill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Tinklepaw, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Don Tinklepaw. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the state in this matter. Judge Jensen properly admitted the evidence of the defendant's prior molestations of his stepdaughter and his niece for the limited purposes of establishing intent and to rebut the defense's claims of mistake and or accident. This was a trial to the court. And the trial court properly admitted the evidence because the circumstances of the prior molestations were found by the trial court to be, quote, nearly identical. If you employ the inverse proportionality test that this court announced in State versus Fisher, the evidence comes in. There was three victims over the course of 20 years. This was a pattern of conduct by the defendant of victimizing female children in his family. The evidence also rebutted the defendant's claim of accident or mistake and claims of no specific intent proof by the state. The prior molestations were nearly identical in the following ways. All of the victims had a familial relationship with the defendant. All of the victims were victimized at around the same ages. The first prior act victim was found to have been victimized between the ages of 6 and 10. The current victim and the second other act victim were found to have been victimized between the ages of 4 and 11. The circumstances and the types of locations where all of the victims were victimized were nearly identical. The other sexual acts that were committed in the other acts evidence were fundamentally the same as the acts that were charged in the indictment. The prior molestations were not too remote as to warrant exclusion, first due to the striking similarity in the facts, right down to what the defendant said to all of the victims. Do you like what I'm doing to you?
Second, a remoteness, though, you know, you will concede we have not allowed a prior act case this old before.
That's correct, Your Honor. I mean, as far as finding a case that said, you know, 22 years ago is okay, you know, just based on age alone, no, I have not found a case that has said that. But if you employ the inverse proportionality test that this court announced in Fisher, in which this court said that the farther out away from the charged offense you get, the more similar in nature the crime has to be. Well, when you consider, as the trial court did and found, the testimony of the current victim with the testimony of the other acts victim, or victims, I should say, whether it was SM 22 years before or LS 12 years before the charged acts, you can easily see that the trial court properly found that these were nearly identical in nature. In analyzing whether the prior molestations were probative and properly admitted under SDCL 19-12-5, as counsel stated, there's many factors to consider. This court has considered similar acts and similar victims. Again, if you look at the testimony of the current victim compared to the other acts victims, it's nearly identical as the trial court found in its findings of fact and conclusions of law. The defendant was charged not only with rape, but with sexual contact with a child under the age of 16, which is a specific intent crime. And this court has stated that circumstantial evidence through the introduction of other acts evidence can be used to show intent. Now, during the pendency of the investigation by law enforcement with the defendant, he did claim mistake or accident or inadvertentness. This was placed into issue at trial, first during opening statements when counsel or defendant stated that the state lacked any proof of specific intent and that any statement made to law enforcement by the defendant were in fact denials. In closing arguments, the defendant argued that the state had not met its burden of proving specific intent and that any statements that the defendant made to law enforcement were in fact statements of inadvertentness, not admissions. Mistake. Accident. This was an issue now. This court also considers the availability of other evidence.
If I can, you said that was in closing argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yep. So all the evidence had already been in then. It wasn't made necessary by the closing argument, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
I should backtrack just a second and say that in all fairness, the defendant began closing argument by saying we are entering a general denial. However, went on to argue that there was a lack of proof of specific intent and that the statements made to law enforcement regarding the touching of the current victim were statements of inadvertentness.
Do you see any difference in this case because it's a court trial versus a jury trial?
Your Honor, the standard of review does not change based on the trier of fact. What it does do is, if anything, it makes it easier because the trial court, as the finder of fact, is charged with entering findings of fact and conclusions of law. And we know from Judge Jensen's clear enunciation on the record and in his findings of fact and conclusions of law how he employed the use of these other acts evidence, and it was for the limited purposes of determining intent and lack of mistake or accident. Now, as counsel noted before, there was, and one of the things that this court considers is the availability of other evidence, and as counsel noted, there were no third-party witnesses. There was no medical testimony that could supplement the current victim's testimony. This court has stated that in the absence of other available testimony, other acts evidence takes on a heightened probative value. The inverse proportionality test that was announced in Fisher was considered by the trial court specifically. It was brought up, it was considered. The trial court distinguished Fisher on the facts, but did employ the inverse proportionality test that was enunciated by this court and determined that although the facts of that case of the prior acts evidence were aged, I believe is what Judge Jensen said in his ruling from the bench, he said that these acts were nearly identical, which allowed for their admission for the limited purposes of establishing intent and lack of mistake or accident. As this was a trial to the court and there were findings of fact and conclusions of law that were entered, and we know that Judge Jensen properly considered the evidence, there is no danger, there is less danger of there being unfair prejudice. We don't have, of course, we don't have findings of fact and conclusions of law when it comes to jury trials. The jury enters its verdict. We have the jury, the trial court judge reads the limiting instruction, and we count on the jury to follow that instruction. And when it comes for review before this court, the court must decide whether or not the jury may have been improperly swayed by an illegitimate means with the introduction of other act evidence. Here, we know that the trial court, as the finder of fact, was not improperly swayed. He did not consider it as merely propensity evidence. He considered it only for the two reasons stated. Defense counsel has argued that the first other act evidence concerning SM, in which he admitted to both other acts, not only to the other acts of victims on tape, but also at a motions hearing on these other acts. He testified and admitted to these other acts. And at trial, he admitted to these other acts, stating, yes, I did those horrible things. But defense counsel looks to distinguish and say that the prejudicial effect in admitting the first prior act's evidence was that the defendant went farther, did more. He masturbated, he ejaculated, he requested fellatio from the first other act victim. There is no indication in the record whatsoever that Judge Jensen placed more weight on that other act evidence because of those facts. The fundamental similarities were there. There was a sexual touching for sexual gratification. That was all that Judge Jensen considered that evidence for. Because Judge Jensen properly admitted this evidence for the proper reasons of determining intent and lack of mistake or accident, we would ask this court to affirm the trial court's ruling and uphold the defendant's conviction. If there are no other questions, I'll ask for my smile from the Chief Justice and take my seat.
Richard Blossom.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tinklepaw. Mr. McGill, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Well, I'll start off with what Mr. Tinklepaw said about the issue of intent and absence of mistake, and that was a factual element. I think we basically are conceding that, and we're saying that even if you accept that prior bad act evidence as relevant to mistake or absence of mistake and intent, there's still the 403 balancing test. In all the cases you said, even if you pass the factual test, you still have to get to the legal test. And I think that's where this whole notion of undue prejudice arises. With respect to the acts that occurred with SM, they're not fundamentally the same. And I said in my brief, it's like comparing the color orange to fire. We're saying that if that were before a fact finder, it would tend to inflame and be highly prejudicial for a fact finder. It'd be hard to keep that in its place, and it would move over and tend to lead a fact finder to convict someone based upon that sensational behavior instead of the acts that occurred between Dennis Walston and KD. We're saying that that it's not harmless error. That if the SM evidence is allowed to stand, it's not harmless error, and that pursuant to STCL 15661, substantial rights were affected, it's prejudicial error, and the case should be remanded for a new trial. That language comes out of the Fisher opinion that was quoted to the court. The other point about Fisher is that dealt with a juvenile. Now, Dennis Most was 18 or 19 at the time that he did that. What happens when someone turns 19 that all of a sudden they're to be fully responsible for all their behaviors, and the analysis that was done with the juvenile is that they're not mature enough. They're a callow teenager, is what it says in the opinion. Dennis was only 19, and now when he's 60 years of age, he's on trial for this crime, and evidence of what he did when he was 19 is coming back in. And I think in the treatise that I cited in my brief, in Rico Ride, the treatise on uncharged misconduct, he makes the point that when you allow in prior bad act evidence or uncharged misconduct, you're making the ultimate inference. You are saying that this person had the same intent when they were 19 years of age, when they were 27 years of age, and when they were 46 years of age, as applied to Dennis Most. So that's what you're really doing. And that's a question of whether when the prior event is dissimilar, whether that gives rise to prejudice. The court has stated that there's no rigid rule. The court was questioning Mr. Tinkelpaw about, is there a case out there in 22 years or 10 years or 8 years? Actually, the statutory guide is 10 years. If a prosecutor wants to put a conviction in a case in chief against the defendant, a prior conviction, I believe the statute says it has to be within 10 years. If it's more than 10 years, I believe they have to have a pre-hearing. So the statutory presumption is that something more than 10 years is stale or remote. But as this court has said, there is no rigid rule on it. And I'd like to apply that there is no rigid rule on that to a juvenile turning 19. If there's no rigid rule on this, then if someone's young and they're 19 years of age, the analysis in Fisher would likewise be applicable to a 19-year-old person who did what Dennis admitted to doing. Mr. Tinkelpaw said that the defendant, through his lawyers, raised intent as an issue, but again, that's irrelevant because we're essentially conceding that and we're focusing on the 403B balancing test. And in any event, it was argument only, arguments not evidence. When Dennis Most took the stand, he made a general denial. He challenged credibility of the complaining witness and his lack of access. And the lack of access is detailed in the record with respect to his work schedule, the number of people that were coming and going in that house. I think I counted 10 or 12 different people who either lived in or were frequent visitors in the house, that he never babysat for the child. He made the case that he just didn't have access to do what this girl claimed. Going to the question of jury trial versus a court trial, I think it's important to note that Mr. Most waived the jury trial in part because he felt that a jury would be inflamed by what happened with SM. Of course, the rule is that you cannot claim unfair prejudice because of the legitimate force of the evidence. So the question is whether this went beyond the legitimate force of the evidence. And there's two cases that come to mind from this court. One is State versus Chamley. And in the Chamley decision, and I cited it in my brief, the current charge was indecent exposure, rape, and sexual contact. The prior bad act, which occurred 12 to 20 years prior to the trial, Mr. Chamley masturbated. He requested the victim to pose nude. He performed cunnilingus. He did a digital rape and sexual contact. In that case, the majority, and Justice Giberson dissented, but the majority ruled.
Number two.
You remember that case?
Oh, yes.
You want to rewrite Chamley. Anyway, in that case, the court ruled that they were remote and dissimilar. They were remote and dissimilar. In the Mueller case, the Becky O'Connor Mueller case, the murder, there's prior bad act evidence in there too. In the opinion explodes out what happened with the three knife incidents that Mueller was involved in and says that they were dissimilar. The point is that you look at these things not just make a general categorical, well, they look to be the same, but you have to take them apart and see if they are really dissimilar. Now, going back to the cases, the Winder case, that case is the oldest case I found in my research, and that was 25 years prior to the trial. The events occurred in 1962 with the prior bad acts. The trial occurred in 1987. That prior bad act evidence was admitted into the trial. It was affirmed by our Supreme Court. The charges against Werner were sexual contact with several children in church outings. That's what the current charge was. At the trial, they brought in several people who claimed that Reverend Werner, his Lutheran minister, had done this to him years before. But the point is this. The offenses were strikingly similar, just as the language in Fisher says. The offenses were strikingly similar. They were the same. There was sexual contact, and that's what he was charged with in this case. So that's just two examples.
2 minutes, counsel.
Thank you. There's two case law examples where prior bad act evidence was approved by the Supreme Court, where it truly was strikingly similar and very remote. 25 years, bordering in our case with most, very remote, but allowed in because it was strikingly similar. And then with respect to Chamley, where there was a variation, a difference, a dissimilarity between what was done years before, in that case, 12 years prior. That was 12 years prior. And it was deemed by this court, at least the court is constituted at that time, as it shouldn't be admitted. So...
Thank you, Mr. McGill. The court will be in recess until 11 o'clock.